Western contemplative traditions affect Western science. You might say that Hutt was trying to stay on the top of one hill while looking longingly over at another. The case was eventually settled out of court, with Hutt agreeing to move out of the astrophysics department. His work didn't fit into any of the four divisions at the Institute, so they created a new interdisciplinary department that was essentially just for him. And that's when the worst moment started to turn to a lucky one. It turned out even luckier than he could have imagined, Barnaby said. He runs his own research area. He can hire anyone without a lengthy vetting process and make his own decisions and create his own activities. If he wants to host yoga camps on the lawn, he can. He has the ultimate in academic freedom. Instead of hosting yoga camps, Hutt has been using the extraordinary freedom to look at big issues like the origins of life and order. He has helped put together a $100 million consortium in Japan to look into these questions and launched a new organization in New York City called Why House, with a stated mission to understand the nature of awareness and the interface between science and technology and civil discourse. If that sounds like a mouthful, Barnaby explained that there are complex concepts to consider as robots play a bigger and bigger role in our lives, like whether robots can have emotions and who is accountable when a robot does something wrong. These are topics being mulled by the biggest technology companies in the world right now, and Pete has become an international leader in this kind of science, completely in a class by himself, Barnaby said. He never could have done all this from his previous position. The worst moment for Pete Hutt led to the lucky opportunity he wanted to pursue his real passions. And his search to understand the most basic questions about life and meaning could make all of us luckier, too. Whether you're pursuing robots, romance, or a new job, bad luck isn't always what it seems. Sometimes it's just the impetus you need to make the good luck happen. Chapter 14, The Ambulance in Your Backyard. Worry about the right things. Stop looking for trouble. Understand what you can control. Listen to your doctor and not your neighbor. Be willing to do nothing. Barnaby arrived for our Wednesday meeting one rainy day, obsessing about staying healthy. Since he has two little daughters, germs were part of the game. One person in his family got a cold and passed it to the next and the next, an endless loop that the parents of many preschoolers know well. I don't have time to be sick, he said, echoing the worry of busy people everywhere. Illnesses, big and small, can seem like the ultimate bad luck that is out of our control. I told Barnaby about a slim 45-year-old woman I met who ran marathons and never smoked and was diagnosed with advanced stage lung cancer. It seemed shocking and random. How could you possibly explain it? Ultimately, there probably is a way to explain it. Researchers continue closing in on more and more discoveries of the genetic and biological underpinnings of disease. But until science has a firmer grasp of them, most of us are frightened by the seeming randomness of how disease strikes. A healthy non-smoker getting lung cancer? How can you control the bad luck that seems uncontrollable? As we look for causes of the unknown, we're not that far removed from the ancient Roman poet Lucretius, who thought people got sickened by seeds in the air, and the ancient Greeks, like Hippocrates, who blamed an imbalance of the four humors. Some early Chinese physicians thought illness came from spirits who had been angered, and even now, many religions believe in divine causes and cures. Instead of focusing on what you don't know and can't control, you can make luck by concentrating on the health issues you can influence. A study led by researchers at the Harvard School of Public Health found that well over a million people in the United States die prematurely every year because they're overweight, smoke, or have high blood pressure. All those early deaths are preventable. Smoking alone accounts for a stunning 1 in 5 deaths. Losing weight or tossing away your cigarettes isn't easy. But if you want to increase your luck of a full and healthy life, it's one of the best approaches. People think about health as just another lottery, Barnaby said, But more often, they put themselves on the path of killing themselves and then blame bad luck. A key to luck is to get yourself on a good path and then worry about the right things. We spend a lot of time worrying about the wrong things, and we get a lot of help with that. Shark attacks worry you? Well, of course. Steven Spielberg's 1975 movie Jaws grossed some $260 million in the United States alone, and the Discovery Channel launched its annual Shark Week programming in 1988. It's now the longest-running cable television event in history. Discovery even tossed in a mockumentary one year, suggesting that a prehistoric shark called the Megalodon had survived and gobbled up a pleasure boat and its crew. The channel has an online feature that lists 20 ways to avoid a shark attack. So if you want to get lucky in the water, you won't swim with a bleeding cut. You'll avoid shiny jewelry and brightly colored swimwear. And you'll stay out of the water if you have an uneven tan, which may resemble the color variations found on fish. Got all that? Oh, and don't wear a wetsuit on a surfboard because it can make you look like a tasty seal. The irony of all this is that, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only about one person a year in the United States dies from a shark attack. But about 10 people die every day of unintentional drowning. Take off the wetsuit because you're worried about sharks, and you may increase your risk of drowning. A wetsuit increases your buoyancy. And if you really want to get lucky in life, you can frolic happily on the beach and not worry about either sharks or drowning, as long as you remember to stick to the speed limit when you're driving home. Close to 100 Americans die every day in traffic accidents. That's 100 every day. Want to get lucky? Put on a seatbelt. You increase your luck when you focus on real facts, not stirred up fears. One doctor I know told me about a patient who came to his office in November 2014 asking questions about how to avoid being struck down by Ebola. The outbreak in West Africa was very real, but she hadn't been to West Africa. She didn't know anybody who had been to West Africa. The only people who had contracted the disease in the United States were two nurses who treated Ebola patients from other countries. A handful of people who got the disease in Africa were being treated in U.S. hospitals, and they were all over the news, he said. So I told her to turn off the TV and take a flu shot. His advice was clearly the best way to increase her health luck in the next few months, since tens of thousands of people die every year from influenza. But she declined the flu shot. She said it had made her friend Mabel sick, said the doctor, with a little shake of his head. Psychologists talk about heuristics, meaning the mental shortcuts we use to make decisions. Looking at statistics, facts, and optimal answers is often very complicated, so we resort to simpler methods. The comment of a friend, a story on the news, or a vague intuition become enough to influence what we think. The problem is that we may use the heuristic that works in one situation to solve another, and sometimes they lead to the wrong conclusions. It's more exciting to talk about sharks than seatbelts, and more dramatic to worry about Ebola than flu. But it's a good idea to dig a little deeper and try some serious reasoning in questions around health. The doctor's recommendation is going to make you luckier than Mabel's. He has seen hundreds of patients before and after flu shots and has a real basis for his advice. But Mabel's anecdotal story hits your emotional buttons and becomes the one that you remember. In this case, though, following the heuristic of what's familiar and comfortable is not necessarily the best idea. My husband is an extremely busy doctor with a sterling reputation and an overdevotion to his patients. And when my sons were little, they got used to his coming home late from the hospital. Running to greet him in their fluffy pajamas, the boys would throw their arms around him and ask, "Did you save any lives today, Daddy?" Ron is an internist, so his regular day isn't an episode of Grey's Anatomy. His office is filled with ordinary people, not bleeding patients needing emergency heart transplants by doctors who are otherwise having sex in the supply room. But recently, one of those ordinary people, whom I'll call Lucy, came in with a bad headache. She was stressed at work, and it would have been reasonable for any internist, particularly one as busy as Ron, to dash off a prescription for migraine medicine or suggest she de-stress with yoga. But she outlined her symptoms clearly, and some combination of experience and instinct told him there was a bigger problem. He sent her down the hall for an MRI. Within an hour, he had studied the scan, seen a brain aneurysm that was beginning to rupture, and had her in the hospital. Another hour and the bleeding into the brain, called a subarachnoid hemorrhage, could have been fatal. "So you saved her life," I said with a smile when Ron told me the story that night. "We should tell the boys. They'd be proud." Ron is an unusually good diagnostician, and I shudder to think what would have happened if Lucy had visited a different internist. Some 30,000 people suffer from a ruptured brain aneurysm every year, and about 40% die. Of those who survive, more than two-thirds have permanent disabilities. With a different outcome, Lucy's friends might have talked about it as one of those tragic events, something you can't prevent. She had just been horribly unlucky. Instead, she's perfectly fine. So how do you make yourself one of the lucky ones in this situation? You want to know what's going on, but demanding more tests isn't necessarily the solution. According to the Brain Aneurysm Foundation, only about 1% of the patients who come to an emergency room with a severe headache have a subarachnoid hemorrhage. In a doctor's office, the number would be even lower. More than 99% of the time, a doctor would be right to mention meditation rather than an MRI. He might give you Excedrin and say to call if the headache gets worse. For Lucy, of course, that would have been too late. It helped that patient and doctor knew each other well enough to talk it through and realize that something seemed far from normal. Both of them communicating and being involved made the difference. At another time, Ron recognized a rare heart condition, and he saved a third patient by diagnosing an impending stroke. So from my vantage, the best way to get lucky with your health is to make sure Ron is your doctor. But that may not be practical. And sorry, he no longer sees new patients. Finding the right doctor can improve your luck, but Dr. Kevin Jones, a much respected researcher at the Huntsman Cancer Institute in Salt Lake City, says you have to play a role in making your own luck too. When I called him one morning to talk about how doctors make decisions, he told me that medical choices aren't always clear-cut. So it's important to encourage the right conversation between the doctor and patient, much as happened with Lucy. The big challenge of medicine is letting patients see how much uncertainty there is, he said. This can be very unsettling, and some patients like a doctor who is brimming with confidence and claims to know exactly what is wrong. But the way doctors think about things is different from how they communicate to patients. He pointed out that doctors essentially think in lists. If, like Lucy, you go to a doctor with a bad headache, he's going to run through in his mind the many different things it's likely to be. He'll probably settle on what's most likely, such as a migraine. But if you tell him it's the worst headache you've ever had in your life, he might think again. That's where you play the role in making your own luck. You have to be the partner in your own healthcare. It's what we call a differential diagnosis, explained Dr. Jones. We'll try a treatment aimed at what is number one on the list. But if it's not working, or there's reason to look further, maybe we need to move on to number two. The line of questions you can ask to improve your luck, said Dr. Jones, is, what are the other possibilities you've considered? Is this really a slam-dunk easy diagnosis, or is there any other treatment you thought about? That level of openness can be challenging on both sides, but Dr. Jones thinks it leads to more lucky outcomes. Some doctors go for swagger, he said, and an air of certainty is great as long as it works. But when it doesn't, you have the patient wondering what happened. Did I do something wrong? Is my doctor an idiot? When really the most likely scenario is that it's just the next thing on the list. As a bone cancer surgeon who specializes in treating rare cancers called sarcomas in children and adults, Dr. Jones knows that by the time people come to him, they have seen many other doctors and are feeling somewhat overwhelmed. Patients often run to many doctors for second and third and fourth opinions, hoping to improve their chance of a lucky result. But Dr. Jones thinks you can just ask any physician where they stand on the range of opinions in the field and whether they're conservative or aggressive. When it comes to cancer, I cut wide and take large margins. There are other people in my field of sarcoma surgery who try to cut as close as they can to tumors. You don't have to get three different opinions. You can ask the doctor his philosophy and how it stacks up against others, he said. As an aside, Dr. Jones is never the first doctor to look at a problem, and getting a second set of eyes on anything serious can be a good idea, just because anyone can miss something. A few days later, I happened to be with a friend in the office of a doctor on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. It was a private office associated with the New York Presbyterian Hospital. And while we waited for the doctor to come into the examining room, we noticed a poster hanging on the wall with five questions patients should ask. The basics were, do I really need this test or procedure? What are the risks? Are there simpler, safer options? What happens if I don't do anything? How much does it cost? The questions were simple and straightforward, and it struck me that by opening the kind of patient-doctor conversations Dr. Jones advised, they could help produce luckier outcomes. I was surprised to note that the poster put the emphasis on challenging procedures rather than asking for more of them. One of the best hospitals in the country was reminding us that when it comes to health, more interventions don't necessarily increase your life or your luck. In medicine right now, that's a huge change and a new direction. Doing some investigating later, I discovered that the poster was even more important than I had realized, because over-testing often leads to very unlucky outcomes. Researchers have given us new technologies and an alphabet soup of ways to look inside the human body. X-ray, ultrasound, CAT, PET, MRI, NMR, MR spectroscopy. The list goes on. Most people figure that the more probing and looking and testing they do, the luckier they'll get. But the exact opposite might be true. It comes down to the maxim that mothers have repeated to their children for generations. If you look for trouble, you'll probably find it. In medicine, that means that if the doctor looks for a problem even when there aren't any symptoms, there's a good chance he'll land on some suspicious finding. Uncertainty may lead to another test, and then another one, and perhaps an invasive procedure just to be sure, and whoops, there's a complication. Now you really are sick, since secondary infections, misdiagnoses, and adverse reactions can kill you. I came across articles in several esteemed medical journals showing that some of the most popular tests, like standard screenings for heart disease and prostate cancer, often do more harm than good. As an article in JAMA Internal Medicine pointed out, no test, not even a non-invasive one, is benign, and often less is more. Excessive tests and procedures waste some $200 billion every year in the United States. Let's forget money for the moment, because focusing on cost makes too many people figure that if they can afford it, they might as well do it. But it could be that all they're doing is buying themselves a greater chance of bad luck. A few years ago, a well-known sports medicine doctor named James Andrews wondered whether MRI scans are overused and misinterpreted. Dr. Andrews knows a thing or two about treating athletes. Back in 1985, he did arthroscopic surgery on baseball pitcher Roger Clemens, who went on to win 7 Cy Young Awards. Clemens also publicly credited Dr. Andrews with saving his career. Other sports stars, including Michael Jordan, Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, and Drew Brees, have also been his patients. As an experiment, Dr. Andrews did MRI scans on 31 professional baseball pitchers in 2011. A pitcher's luck depends on how well his arm functions. And Dr. Andrews found that 27 of the pitchers had rotator cuff damage and 28 had abnormal shoulder cartilage. But here's the kicker. Every one of the athletes was perfectly healthy and pitching just fine. Doing surgery would be the unluckiest thing they could do. If you want an excuse to operate on a pitcher's throwing shoulder, just get an MRI, he said. Other doctors have pointed out that scans almost always turn up something abnormal. It is very rare for an MRI to come back with the words normal study. I can't tell you the last time I've seen it, said Christopher DiGiovanni, an orthopedic surgeon now at Massachusetts General Hospital. It's not just the highly sensitive MRI that causes unlucky interventions. Other studies have suggested that scans of a normal runner's knee will regularly turn up ripped cartilage and torn ligaments, even if the person is in no pain. Put a heart monitor on someone for long enough, as many cardiologists now do, and there will be occasional periods of fast heartbeats. But if there are no symptoms, should you treat these perceived problems? Once you get started looking and treating, it's very hard to say no. One recent study found that in a single year, 25 to 42% of Medicare patients are subjected to a needless treatment. All this is more than theoretical, since there's a good chance you or someone you know has been through the experience. It happened to me twice. Once a doctor convinced me to get a mammogram, even though I was not yet 40. Why wait? He asked. I later discovered I would have been luckier to wait. The test found a tiny something that the doctor was sure was benign, but we should do a biopsy anyway, he said. So I went to the hospital early one morning and put on a blue gown and paper slippers and sat freezing in the waiting room for an hour while my husband kept his arm protectively around me. Then I was led to the surgical suite and attacked by a scalpel. Of course it was fine. Given how young I was, the odds of a false positive on that mammogram far outweighed the likelihood of a real finding. So there was nothing wrong at all, except the surgeon cut a little more than she should have for the biopsy, and it took many months for my body to return to normal. Then a few years ago, another doctor recommended a scan just as a double-triple check for what seemed to me a perfectly normal symptom. Again, I agreed, because how do you say no? The scan was fine, but turned up an incidental finding of a little thingy. And if there's a little thingy, a doctor wants to follow it up. So there were more tests, follow-ups for several months. I finally asked the radiologist if she had ever seen this kind of thingy turn to something more dangerous, and she said, "I haven't in my experience, but that doesn't mean it's impossible." Her experience included more than 30 years, so I decided enough was enough. But then my doctor shockingly suggested surgery. "Nothing seems wrong, but I can do it in a morning, and then you'll know it's gone," he said. This time I did say no, as loudly as I could. I switched doctors. I didn't do any more scans. I am fine and healthy. I happen to be one of the least medically anxious people you'll ever meet, so I got through both of these incidents without too much trouble. But it made me realize how intervention leads to intervention, and the pursuit of good health can lead to bad luck. It's estimated that more than 200,000 people die every year from hospital mistakes. So if you want to stay lucky, you don't do an unnecessary surgery. You stay out of a hospital unless you really need one. And if you do have to be admitted, don't linger there longer than absolutely necessary. Most of us aren't very good at assessing risks, and statistics are more likely to scare us than lead us in a lucky direction. But after I spent one morning reading up on Bayes' theorem, I finally understood why tests sometimes cause more problems than they solve. Reverend Thomas Bayes came up with the complicated mathematical formula back in the 1700s. But math aside, it essentially says that the probabilities of events change as you get more specific information. Let's say there's a fatal disease that strikes one in 1,000 people in your demographic. The test to find out if you have it is 90% accurate, which means only 10% false positives, and is 100% accurate if you do have the disease. Since it's cheap and easy and you're anxious, you go ahead with it. A couple of days later, the doctor calls and in hushed tones tells you the bad news. Your test was positive. You hang up the phone reeling. Given the odds, you assume you have a 90% chance of facing a swift and awful death. But don't book that final around-the-world cruise just yet, because the truth is that the odds are on your side. you're luckier than you realize. Here's where Bayes' theorem comes in. Let's give the test to 1,000 people and put all those who get a positive result onto that cruise. Since the disease strikes 1 in 1,000 and the test is 100% accurate in finding the disease if you do have it, the one genuinely stricken person will have a positive result. Send her to the ship. But remember, the test is 90% accurate overall, so it will also return 10% false positives. 10% of 1,000 is 100, which means all those people will have a positive test too. We now have another 100 people to go on that cruise. Your test was positive, so you're one of the people on the ship. Now look around. There are 101 folks there, and only one is actually sick. Feeling a little more confident? Instead of a 90% likelihood of the awful disease, you have a less than 1% chance. Pretty cool, isn't it? The big variable is how many people have the disease to start with. If the disease is common, there will be a lot more people on that ship from the group that actually is sick, and so your odds aren't quite as good. The probabilities may change when you look by age or location or gender, and that explains why a mammogram on a woman under 40 is so much more likely to have a false positive than a real finding of cancer. There just aren't that many women who have the disease at that age, so the cruise is filled with false positives and very few actual cases. Whenever medical panels recommend against certain tests, like mammograms on women below a certain age, it's because the panels see that the dangers of false positives far outweigh the bigger benefits. But inevitably, the one person on that cruise who did have the disease announces that her life was saved, so why would we ever change the policy? Reasonable arguments can be made on both sides. Activists will claim that the government is looking only to cut costs at the expense of health. But maybe the opposite is true. Maybe we increase our health and luck when we cut costs and stop looking for problems that don't necessarily exist with the prevalence that we imagined. Sometimes doing too much means our luck sails away. No matter how careful you are, the world is still filled with viruses and pathogens and tree roots to trip over. And there's a good chance that one of them will get you. When that happens, you make yourself luckier by knowing what to expect and how to prepare. Barnaby told me that a few years ago, his mother was very ill and needed attention quickly. They were in Philadelphia at the time and quite near the excellent hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. So he packed his mom into the car and got her to the emergency room. He knew it was an excellent teaching hospital that could handle complex situations, but he wasn't prepared for the scene he encountered. The ER waiting room was packed, and there were people screaming in pain, and a few were lying on the linoleum floor. One woman was crying that her chest hurt and she was afraid of dying, Barnaby said, shaking his head at the memory. When we signed in, the person at the desk said they tried to see people as quickly as possible, and the wait was currently 4 hours. Barnaby called a friend who had previously been an anesthesiologist at the hospital to see if she could help. She just sighed and said, "This is the situation in many emergency rooms in America, Barnaby. I'm sorry." But Barnaby is never deterred. He called his own doctor and described the situation, and the doctor realized it was urgent enough to intervene. They were moved to the front of the line. Waiting times in emergency rooms vary around the country, and the worst situation is often if you have an injury or broken bone. You're in pain and want something done now. But in terms of triage, you're low on the list. You don't die from a sprained ankle. According to the website ProPublica, in most parts of the country, if you go to an ER with a broken bone, you'll spend an average of an hour or so before you even receive pain meds. Having a relationship with a primary care physician can increase your luck after an injury or when you're deciding if you need an ER. Over the years, I've heard my husband on the phone late at night with patients probably hundreds of times, calmly assessing a situation and advising the panicked person on the next steps to take. If you don't have a primary care physician now, finding one is an easy way to increase your luck. Sure, most doctors see a lot of patients, and some studies have questioned whether an annual physical really improves health. But that regular visit does give you a connection to a doctor who can coordinate your care and make the call to the emergency room if necessary to get you admitted. In the Lucky in Health sweepstakes, that counts for a lot. Barnaby and I gave a call to Dr. Neha Vapiwala, advisory dean at the Perelman School of Medicine and director of the residency program there, to talk about how to make luck inside a hospital. Most of the better hospitals in the country are now putting safety practices in place and trying to change the dismal fact that medical mistakes are now the third leading cause of death in the country. That's pretty stunning. Only cancer and heart disease kill more people than medical mistakes. Dr. Vapiwala suggested that you increase the likelihood of a lucky outcome if you have someone who can hang around the hospital with you, be your advocate, and keep an eye on things. Don't assume that everyone else knows what's going on, and therefore you shouldn't ask a question, she said. There are many mistakes that can get made, so you want to trust but verify. I thought about a story a young doctor named Brittany told me. A friend of hers had been hospitalized for early complications from a pregnancy. One night, a nurse woke her up at midnight, saying it was time to take her pills. My friend said, "Are you sure? I've been here a week, and I never got medicine in the middle of the night." The nurse insisted, but my friend wouldn't take it. Brittany shook her head. It was midnight, and she'd been woken up and was drowsy, but she still managed to question it. How many people could do that? It was good that she did, because, sure enough, the nurse had brought the medicine to the wrong patient. She was there trying to save her pregnancy, so imagine the consequences if she'd taken drugs that weren't even for her, Brittany said. When she told me the story, Brittany herself was pregnant, and knowing too much about the ins and outs of hospitals had made her somewhat panicked about her own delivery. She had decided to have a doula with her, just so there could be one more person asking questions and making sure no mistakes were made. I mentioned the story to Dr. Vapiwala, who quickly agreed that you make your own luck by staying involved with your care. You should have the comfort level to talk to the doctors and nurses treating you, she said. Some people are afraid to antagonize the team, just like they don't want to upset the waiter who is bringing their food. But the outcomes here are more significant than an overdone burger or a soggy salad. Dr. Vapiwala suggested that you need to be able to find a tone of questioning without negativity, and the team treating you needs to be able to hear it. After we hung up, I came across a new study out of Israel that looked at how doctors and nurses dealt with the fragile, vulnerable babies in an intensive care unit. Using simulated scenarios, the researchers found that when a parent said something rude, the doctors and nurses made more errors and their skills deteriorated. They weren't being vindictive, they knew they were being evaluated, but their performance slipped anyway. The authors of the study concluded that the rude comments distracted the doctors and nurses and drew their cognitive resources from the work they needed to do. We are all human beings. We are affected by rudeness, said one of the authors of the study. So the conclusion from all this is that if you want to get lucky during a hospitalization, you need to take charge of your own care, make sure someone is advocating for you, ask questions but not in a negative way, and avoid rudeness that can have negative repercussions. Too complicated? Nobody said getting lucky was easy. Making your own luck in health is a lot easier if money isn't a problem. Reading up on the subject, I found several studies showing that the richest 1% of Americans live up to 15 years longer than the poorest 1%. That's a fairly stunning gap. This pattern isn't new. Having money has led to longer life for at least a couple of centuries. The standard explanation is that if you have money, you can get the best doctors and the best care. Or more important, you can see a doctor at all. One series of reports found that low-income Americans don't go to doctors because they can't afford them, leading to worse outcomes. But it's more complicated than that. A study published in JAMA found that poorer Americans have a dramatically different life expectancy depending on where they live. It starts to seem that healthcare interventions make a difference, but far more important to longevity are individual behaviors. People who abuse drugs and alcohol die sooner. People who exercise, don't smoke, and stay within a normal weight range live longer. Sure, you can blame your health problems on bad genes, but most studies now estimate that only about 25% of the variation in longevity is caused by genetic factors. Whatever your income level and family background, you can make luck in health by the choices you make. And the choices have to be rational, not based on the latest trends or pseudoscience. One man I know keeps to a careful gluten-free and meat-free diet. He doesn't have an actual gluten allergy, he just thinks it's better. But he also drinks about 5 glasses of wine a night. I've tried to tell him that there's actual evidence showing excessive alcohol can cause harm, and almost nothing that says meat and gluten will do you in. He thinks he's making himself luckier, but I'm not so sure. Trying to make yourself luckier in health matters can take many forms. Barnaby has an enormously wealthy friend who lives in one of the largest townhouses in Manhattan and also has several other homes around the world. He's used to controlling a lot of things in his life, and so he has spent some time figuring out how to get lucky in health. He decided he could increase his luck by having a fully outfitted ambulance at each of his homes, Barnaby told me. In some circumstances, your luck depends on how fast you can be treated, and this was his insurance that he would always get immediate attention. Okay, that made sense. The rest of us couldn't afford our own ambulances, but we could use his example to make a plan for how to get to a hospital in an emergency. My home in Connecticut is in a fairly remote area, at least an hour from any highly skilled hospital, so it inspired me to think about what I would do if something happened. Barnaby told me that his friend got the ambulances and hired staff to attend to them. I liked this story as a quirky example of how unconventional thinking can reduce risk and create luck. But then came a twist. On one particular day at his home in the Caribbean, the businessman decided to test out his system. He raced over to the ambulance, which was right there waiting for him, and he was ushered into the back. All was working as planned. The driver got behind the wheel and hit the ignition, but nothing happened. The car wouldn't start. It turned out that the driver, bored from all the hours of sitting around, had been listening to a soccer game on the car radio all day. The battery was dead. Barnaby and I laughed about the story. You can try hard to make yourself lucky in health issues by taking control of what you can, but you still can't foresee everything. On a Friday night, in the midst of thinking about luck and health, I went to Broadway to see the new musical Groundhog Day. The audience was packed with critics and reporters. The show was about to officially open, so it was an important night. The show, based on the popular movie, was terrific, and by intermission it was clear that lead actor Andy Carl was the breakout star of the season. He was handsome and funny and perfect in the role. The audience loved him. I loved him. The fast-paced show required lots of physical exertion from Carl, but he made it seem effortless. Then, toward the end of the show, he was dashing across the stage, did a leap, and landed wrong. He fell, and his knee gave out. He crawled off the stage. The show stopped, and the curtain came down. The stage manager asked if there was a doctor in the house. It turned out that Carl had badly injured his knee, but after 20 minutes or so, he decided to finish. The curtain came up again with the star center stage, and barely able to walk, Carl leaned on scenery and a makeshift cane. His face was contorted with pain, but he kept singing and charming. By coincidence, the lyrics of one of the songs included the lines, "I'm here and I'm fine," and the audience roared approval. At the end, the audience jumped up cheering for him, and Carl looked out to the standing ovation, tears streaming down his face. He wasn't just the new star of Broadway. He was an inspiration. We all face challenges, and sometimes all you can do is to keep going and trying to make the best of whatever situation you have. Leaving the theater, I thought of an Arabic-speaking friend of mine who had told me that there wasn't a word in his language for accident. The word we use is hadit, which means more incident or event, he said. Hadit was a good way to think about that night. Getting injured was just one of those events that happens and can't be anticipated. Carl had done everything right to prepare. He was in great shape, with the muscles to prove it, and had probably done that leap 100 times in rehearsal. When an incident occurs, whether a busted knee or an unexpected diagnosis, we still have a role in how our luck unfolds. We can give up and bemoan the fates and the bad timing. Or we can decide to face whatever happens with a firm determination to make our own luck and a decision that the show and life must go on. Chapter 15. How to get lucky in a disaster, natural or otherwise. Get all the information you can. Take time to prepare, even if you feel silly. Engage your higher brain. Avoid wishful thinking. Spending a warm May weekend on campus for my college reunion, I slipped away from the socializing one afternoon and sat in the back of a classroom as a young professor of geology named Maureen Long talked about earthquakes and tsunamis and other problems related to natural disasters. I left thinking I should have been a geology major, which clearly shows what a good teacher she is. When I saw Barnaby the next week, I mentioned that her lecture had inspired me to think about who survives natural disasters and who doesn't. Was it simply random chance, or did the survivors do something right to prepare? There had to be a way to increase your luck in these unluckiest of situations. Earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, tsunamis, and other natural disasters seem shocking each time they occur, but they happen fairly regularly. Airplane crashes aren't exactly natural, but they seem to fit in the same category. How do you become the person who walks away unharmed? It's such a good question, Barnaby said, and I've thought about it a lot because my mother was once the earthquake planner for the state of Alaska. I gave a little laugh. I had yet to find a topic that Barnaby didn't have some experience with. He explained that his mom had trained in arts and design and knew nothing about seismic science, but she was spirited and entrepreneurial and got the Alaska job anyway. She learned the science quickly and tried to raise earthquake awareness through programs in schools and public brochures, but she was stymied at every turn by powerful people who owned land and property in vulnerable spots and didn't want the topic discussed. Alaska is on the Ring of Fire, which is basically the most earthquake-prone set of plates in the world, Barnaby told me. A great earthquake that struck on Good Friday of 1964 was the most powerful in the history of America and the second most powerful ever recorded in the world, 9.2 on the Richter scale. Given Alaska's sparse population, casualties were limited, though more than 100 people died in the tsunamis that followed. There was extensive damage in downtown Anchorage, but just a few hours after the quake, an influential property developer named Wally Hickel announced he would rebuild, Barnaby said. Geologists urged him not to, but he put up a luxury hotel anyway. Maybe it's not so surprising that a developer, politician, who puts his name on buildings, values his own profits, and ignores long-term consequences. When he eventually ran for office, people liked Hickel's promises of prosperity, and he became governor. His legacy of supporting business may seem less reasonable if another earthquake sweeps through. Anybody who wants to be lucky when visiting Anchorage should be careful about staying in hotels built on questionable land, Barnaby advised. When it comes to natural disasters, we're not very good at thinking ahead. I couldn't find a single review of Hickel's hotel on TripAdvisor that mentioned earthquakes. And why would anyone really think of that? If you want to play the odds, you figure that a big one isn't going to strike just when you're spending a night in Anchorage before your Alaskan cruise. But eventually, the odds can go against you. A geophysicist named Mary Lou Zoback spent years trying to get the city of San Francisco to pay more attention to the earthquake readiness of its buildings. But like Barnaby's mom, she came up against real estate interests worried about property values. Eventually, they realized there was some grassroots interest in the safety of buildings, she told us. The San Francisco earthquake of 1906 killed some 3,000 people, and more than 100 years later, Zoback pointed out that some of the most popular spots in the city, like the marina and the financial district, are built in sensitive areas. During an earthquake, the buildings on top of them could be vulnerable. But better luck may be on the way. Laws have passed that require people to buttress older structures, and all the new building taking place in San Francisco, and there's a lot of it, has to be earthquake resistant. Thoroughly intrigued now by how you could stay lucky in an earthquake, I gave a call to the professor I'd met at my reunion, Maureen Long, and told her how much I'd enjoyed her talk to alums. "Oh, that makes me happy," she said. "It's such an exciting subject to understand." As warm on the phone as she had been in person, she told me that she decided to become a geophysicist when she was in eighth grade and took the standard course on earth science. She was captivated by plate tectonics, the study of the underlying structures of the earth. "I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever heard of," she said. The movement of the plates leads to earthquakes and volcanoes, but Professor Long pointed out that they may have a lucky side, too. Other planets like Mars and Venus don't have plate tectonics, and there's the possibility that over millions and tens of millions of years, they contribute to our planet's habitability. "We're trying to understand what it is about the Earth that leads to this very specific behavior, with the plates moving around and the oceanic crust getting recycled back into the mantle and building continents," she said. "The fact that the Earth can exchange material between its interior and its oceans over millions of years might play a role in regulating the very long-term carbon cycle of the planet. It speaks to a lot of fundamental questions about what allowed life to develop." That did sound pretty cool, and lucky too. But on a shorter-term basis, the plate shiftings mean earthquakes are a lot more common than you think. There are about 15 magnitude 7 earthquakes a year, and you don't want to be around when one hits. Many of them happen far away from people and infrastructure, so we don't hear about them on the evening news. But then comes one like the 2010 Haiti earthquake, which killed well over 100,000 people, some estimates go much higher, and offered a devastating reminder that poor infrastructure and a complete lack of preparedness can lead to very, very bad luck. Tragedy often hits unexpectedly, but sometimes there are warning signals that can give time to prepare. The earthquake that rumbled under the Indian Ocean in 2004 was a magnitude 9, the third largest ever recorded, and unleashed a devastating tsunami. The first waves, really walls of water, that ravaged the coast of Thailand came quickly. Vacationers lolling on the beaches were submerged in the swirling water, and there was no obvious way to prepare to be lucky. But across the ocean, waves continued to propagate, and tens of thousands of fatalities occurred in places far away many hours later. "You need systems in place ahead of time so people can be warned and evacuate," said Professor Long. "Without these systems, the tsunami killed some 250,000 people in 14 countries. Scientists can't yet predict where and when an earthquake will occur, but there are other ways to get warnings. You can sometimes get 30, 40, or 50 seconds of warning, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it means you can shut down the nuclear reactor and get the subway trains out of the tunnel. It's a very exciting innovation," she said. The systems exist in Japan and are being developed in California and the Pacific Northwest. The advance notice means you might get lucky enough to move to a doorframe or duck under a table and avoid falling debris. Widespread luck in natural disasters often requires a carefully prepared official plan, like early warning systems and safer building codes. But when the governments don't do enough, the rest of us are left on our own. We have to figure out the steps that will make us lucky even when others aren't. Barnaby suggested we talk to Lawrence Gonzalez, who has been writing about dangerous situations for years. He's looked at everything from wilderness accidents to plane crashes, trying to understand who survives and who doesn't. In a long conversation with him, we discovered that when it comes to disaster preparedness, Gonzalez is a do-everything kind of guy. He told us that he and his wife had been at a doctor's office the previous day when a fire alarm went off. She was writing a check at the reception desk, and he said, she didn't even hesitate. She dropped her checkbook, walked over to me, and we went straight to the exit and out. Was it a false alarm? It usually is. But if an alarm goes off, you leave the building. Otherwise, why have a fire alarm? It's a good point, but most of us don't leave the building the moment we hear an alarm. We hesitate, we try to get more information, we see what everybody else is doing. Our instinct is to believe that everything is okay. Many years ago, my husband and I were asleep in our suburban home with our then very young children down the hall. At about 3 a.m., the burglar alarm sounded, and the phone rang immediately, with our alarm company calling to check. My husband reached for the phone. False alarm, he said groggily, and he gave the code that said all was well. He hung up, and I looked at him in shock. Why did you do that? I asked. He got out of bed and in his boxer shorts went downstairs to look for intruders. I'm not sure what he would have done if he found one. Fortunately, it was a false alarm, but we have talked about that night often. The psychoanalyst Stephen Grosz wouldn't have been surprised. In his book, The Examined Life, he points out how difficult it is for us to break our usual patterns. My husband is competent and self-sufficient, and those traits usually work out well. They are his instinctive fallback. He had never encountered an alarm in our home that wasn't set off by mistake. But hearing an alarm in the middle of the night, he might have done better to try shutting off his natural instincts. Grosz said that in one nightclub fire, some people went to pay their checks before leaving, and others died because they tried to leave through the door they entered. Oftentimes, people simply linger too long. They may smell the smoke, but they wait to see the flames. We resist change, committing ourselves to a small change, even one that is unmistakably in our best interest, is often more frightening than ignoring a dangerous situation, he said. Lawrence Gonzalez pointed out that we create mental models that let us acclimatize to almost anything. He described how his little granddaughter first saw a garbage truck when she was not yet 2 years old, and she was scared and excited as it roared by. But once she had seen the truck enough times, she stopped noticing it. She incorporated it into a model that allows her to proceed through life efficiently, he told us. As a grown-up, you can't live happily or make yourself lucky if you're stunned or scared by every event. You acclimatize. You recognize that not everything needs your attention. But sometimes you become so comfortable that you don't realize when you're facing danger. Gonzalez told us that on the Gulf Coast of Texas, where he grew up, people would have hurricane parties. You didn't get out of town or go into a big building to protect yourself. You ordered a bunch of booze and had your friends over, he said. Before one very big hurricane some years ago, the sheriff headed over to a row of apartment houses on a Galveston beach to warn people that the storm was coming and they needed to leave. One group that was partying on a fifth-floor balcony called back, "Hey, don't sweat it. We do this every year." And they just laughed and waved. The storm surf in that hurricane was 35 feet, and it killed all those people, Gonzalez told us. This is the classic story of how mental models can undermine us. If you're accustomed to hurricanes and fire alarms and garbage trucks that don't lead to problems, how do you know when you've hit the one that's different? Gonzalez thinks that lucky people are those who are more alert to warning flags and have less tolerance for close shaves. I've been a pilot most of my life, flying airplanes, and my motto is that I'd rather be on the ground wishing I were in the air than in the air wishing I were on the ground, he said. When he rented a plane, his rule of thumb was that if he found three things wrong with it, he would reject it, figuring that there were even more problems that he hadn't yet found. I could see how setting up parameters ahead of time might work in all sorts of situations. Instead of falling into the mode of assuming all is well, you have guidelines that kick in, and your rational brain would have to purposefully override them. However smoothly our lives normally go, we are often teetering on the edge of unrecognized disaster. And Gonzalez thinks we make ourselves lucky by cultivating an attitude of a little more humility and suspicion. When a system is complex, the likelihood of catastrophic failure is extremely high. Gonzalez calls it the dinner party paradox. Imagine that you've made a reservation at a very popular restaurant where your entire party has to arrive exactly on time or you don't get the table. You have reliable friends who are 90% likely to be on time. The question is, how many friends can you invite before you're pretty much assured of not having dinner? Your first instinct, like mine, is probably invite as many as you want. My friends are 90% reliable. But doing the math gives a surprising answer. Once you have more than 6 people, the reservation is probably doomed, and you'll end up having to catch a burger at the local diner. Now take a system like a DC-10 aircraft, which has 250,000 parts, or the space shuttle with significantly more, said Gonzalez. Even if you manufacture each part to 99.9% reliability, do the arithmetic, and there comes a level of complexity beyond which a catastrophic failure is absolutely certain. When those big disasters happen, our instincts kick in and usually lead to a dramatic response. There's the oft-discussed fight-or-flight syndrome, and what some neuroscientists call the rage circuit. Think what happens when you hit your thumb with a hammer. But to be the lucky survivor, you sometimes have to fight against all those instincts. If you can bring your higher brain, your logical brain, into the picture, then you can start to manage these automatic responses in a way that's going to be useful, Gonzalez said. I asked Gonzalez how you can engage that higher brain, and he suggested activities that are patterned, rhythmic, repeated, and directed towards some goal. Knitting seems to fit the list, as does sharpening knives, or playing a musical instrument, or a game of pool. They all have a linear, step-by-step engagement of the thinking brain that has a calming effect, because it engages the neocortex and helps you dominate your emotional responses, said Gonzalez. In the middle of a disaster, you're not going to start knitting to get yourself under control. But Gonzalez thinks that if you've trained your nervous system ahead of time with those calming activities, you have a better chance of getting through. Part of the process of righting yourself in an emergency is believing that it's possible, he said. A couple of years ago, my husband built an enormous deck on our country house. It took all summer, hours and hours each weekend, and he got great satisfaction in the methodical work of situating each plank and pounding it into place. Don't ask me. I didn't understand it at all. But now it occurred to me that in his real life as a doctor, Ron is faced by daily crises and emergencies. He needs that higher brain ability to cope with them rationally and unemotionally. And maybe building a deck or playing the piano, which he also does, helps with that. If so, it's fine with me. The deck looks great. Finding a way to get the rational mind working and engaged in an emergency can make all the difference between emerging as one of the lucky ones or not. Gonzalez said that when he and his wife check into a hotel room, they immediately walk down the hall to the exit stairway to familiarize themselves with what they would do if they had to crawl out in a smoky fire. That sounds a little excessive, I said. You travel a lot and hotel fires are pretty rare. Is it really worth your time? You have to think about the risk-reward loop, he said. What do I gain and what do I lose? If there's a fire and I don't get out, I'm dead. In going down the hall to find the exit, I'm just using a few minutes of my precious TV watching time. Okay, fair enough. But after we hung up, I thought that we also shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking we can control or predict every disaster. By its very nature, a disaster is unexpected. And the lucky people will be those who keep their wits and higher brain function no matter what happens. You can check the emergency exits every place you go, but if there's a disaster during your hotel stay, it's probably going to be something completely unexpected. Instead of turning on the TV, Maybe you could use the extra time to prepare your brain by knitting. At least you get a sweater out of it. When a cool head meets a hot disaster, there can be unexpected success. That was the case in early 2009, when a U.S. Airways flight leaving LaGuardia Airport was hit by a flock of geese a few minutes after takeoff. Both engines went out, and pilot Chesley